Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 2004, is with the late Walter B. Wriston, former chairman and CEO of Citicorp Citibank, and Bob Chittister, founder of the Free to Choose Network. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, Walter, I'm not an expert on banking, but I can remember a half century ago.
A half century ago, right.
I'm getting there slowly. But in my small town in Pennsylvania, there's like 3,000 people in this town. Yet there were two banks, and they were freestanding banks.
Right.
And I was thinking about it flying in today, and I thought, you know, my sense was as a kid, it was almost going into a bank at that, for me then, was almost like going to church. It was like, it was this very closed in environment. Everybody, it's like the gates are there, the cages are there, the people are behind the cages, and you're on this side. It's like you're going in to do confession or something. How much the world of banking has changed in that interim period, it just fascinates me. I assume you started out when banking was of that kind.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a town, we had two banks. And the Great Depression came, and the question was, would both of those banks fail? And the money of the university where my father worked was in one bank, and they got a DC-3, and they flew in bar gold from Chicago, and they landed in what was laughingly called an airport, and put it on a spring wagon, horses, and they were put it down College Avenue and piled the bar gold in front of one of the banks. And that bank survived. The other one failed. And of course, the bar gold was an indication to the population that they had a call on resources. Obviously, they couldn't be turned into cash. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, that saved that bank. But half of the town lost all their assets in the bank that failed, and we were fortunate in that it was in the bank that survived, but that was the kind of situation that there were. There were 30,000 banks in the United States in 1929-30, around that time. Now 5,000 or 6,000, something like that. Mm-hmm. And before telecommunications and before Eisenhower's Interstate Highway and before television, each one of those little banks served a community. And they were highly vulnerable because if all of their loans were to the wheat crop and there was a drought and there wasn't any wheat crop, those banks carried the farmers, but they were totally illiquid, obviously. Mm-hmm. And the only rule of banking is diversification. And none of those little banks had diversification. And so when the wind blew and the shoe factory went out of business, they went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So that despite that, the small town banks fought tooth and nail never to have a chain banking.
Right, because they would lose their monopoly position.
And the visionary who tried to change that was Giannini. And he had a vision of nationwide banking with the Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget or don't know that the Bank of America had a big branch in New York City.
I didn't realize
and
that.
In 1935 or 6, its entire capital was wiped out. And Giannini came to the Citibank and said, will you save it? And the Citibank bought the Bank of America. And Giannini went on the board of Citibank.
Hmm.
And you can imagine what the antitrust people thought of that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And not only did he go on the board, but when he retired, his daughter went on the board. And eventually, it was broken up due to antitrust. Uh-huh. But that was, he had the original vision to Giannini.
Yeah.
But through a set of bad loans or whatever, it didn't take off.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a small town yourself. Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in Middletown, Connecticut, which is a small town too. But I grew up in Appleton, Wisconsin, which had the two banks that I referred to.
Mm. And your father at that time was?
He was president of Lawrence College.
Oh, Lawrence College.
Which is now Lawrence University.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a small family or a large family?
Lots of a typical American boy, girl, father, mother.
Father, mother.
Yeah, right.
The just right amount of each kind.
Right out of the movies.
Is your sister alive?
She is indeed. She's a very distinguished architectural historian. Has written a definitive book on the architecture of Bath.
Ooh.
She lectures at the Metropolitan. She ran the educational department of the Chicago Institute of Fine Arts for 20 years.
Oh, she did?
Prior to that, she ran it at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. And one day she called me up and said, I'm coming to New York. And I said, what are you going to use for eating money? She said, oh, I'll lecture at the Met and so forth. And she did.
And she does.
She's now retired mostly from that area.
Mm-hmm. What was your favorite activity as a child? Do you recall?
Probably playing tennis.
Playing tennis, yeah, even probably. As a child? Oh. Yeah.
Since I was a child.
Did you compete? Did the high school have competition? Or did
I
play
played,
the club?
I won a couple of small town tournaments and made a mistake, as usual. When I got to college, I played freshman tennis and talked myself into thinking that you would never do that after you were out of college. So I took up squash. And I played a lot of squash during college. Not very well, actually. And
you're better at tennis.
Yeah. And I don't think when I went to Washington, I played squash with the old Brookings Institute. They had a squash court there. But then I didn't play it again for, I guess, forever.
Forever, right?
So it was just another bum decision I made.
Well, at least you got back to the tennis, as
right,
I understand.
Right, which is fun. It's a sport in which you can play for an hour and get a little exercise and have a lot of fun. And if you don't take it too seriously.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a childhood hero?
Well, I don't know. I think that there were a lot of role models around, so to speak, that people saw in those days that were stretching the envelope, like Lindbergh's trip across the Atlantic, Post and Getty, who flew around the world. I remember listening to that on a radio that I'd built. And at that point, that was an enormous event in the
of
world.
Of course.
And, but the family was, my father was, and mother, were both teachers. And so we would wind up at the dinner table with books all over the place, arguing about this, that, and the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it created a atmosphere in which you wanted to know about new things.
Mm-hmm.
And it taught me that life is a series of accidents. And when you're old enough, you make believe you planned it that way. But my father's life was a series of accidents. Mine was total accidental, just about everything. And so I like to tell the kids coming in the bank, you know, all this career planning is wonderful, but the chances of it happening that way are small.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you do your own job every day and do it better than the other guy, tomorrow takes care of itself. And of course, nobody who's young believes that.
Right. It's interesting. I'd have to say the same thing. I think my career has been accidental. But I've always thought that making an adventure out of life and out of your career was a commendable thing. Is that the kind of approach you took?
I don't know that I had an approach. I mean, you just... there are occasions when I was in an officer of the Department of State, my boss, we had a hospital ship that was captured by the Japanese. And my boss said, "Are you familiar with the hospital ship treaty?" And I said, "Yes, indeed." And I had never heard of the hospital ship treaty. But I got it out of the library and spent all night on it. And by the morning, I was an expert on it.
And right.
I wrote all the notes that the Secretary of State eventually signed to try to free the people who were mm-hmm. on that hospital ship. And that was one of many incidences where opportunity is presented to you, and you seize it.
You seize it. It sounds to me as if your upbringing, in many ways, you were involved in a homeschooling environment, that both your parents as teachers. I mean, was it that purposeful? Did they really?
Oh, no, it was a lucky strike extra on the thing. My mother went to college at a time when very few women did, and she taught physics for a while, which very few women did. But when we moved out to Appleton, she didn't teach at all. What she did was she invented lending artworks to college students, and started with a very small collection of etchings, and would rent them to college students in their room mm-hmm. in an effort to try and raise the cultural level of these folks. And today there is the Ruth Wriston Art Center out in Lawrence, which today has a very fine collection, which started with her, I think, two or three etchings, something like that. Mm-hmm. My sister's more knowledgeable about it than I am by far.
Mm-hmm. What was your college career like? Did you?
Oh, it was rocky. I came out of a high school which would not win any prizes on academic standards. Mm-hmm. And I got to college and...
Where'd you go?
I went to Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. And my counselor, when I got there, called me aside and he said, "Your father is an academic, isn't he?" And I said, "Yes, he is." And he said, "Well, according to your test scores, you will flunk out of Wesleyan in the first semester, and that will embarrass him no end. And it would be much better if you would leave now before you start, and then you won't be embarrassed."
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, "I've been taking IQ tests since I was, I guess, 9 or 10, because Mr. Thorndike, who invented the darn things, would come to dinner with us, and my sister and I hated all of them. And when I was, I don't know, 12 or 14, I took an IQ test and everybody clapped hands. And it was 2 points below Einstein, and I only missed one question. And then I took it about three or four years later, and I had sunk down into ordinary IQ, and I took it just before I came to college, and it showed I wouldn't be able to tie my shoes without help. So I said, my knowledge about IQ tests as a predictor is zero, and I don't believe you. And when I graduate, I'll send you a telegram wherever you may be. And I called my father, and he was incensed. And I said, well, and I had a terrible time because the first year in college, the Deerfield people and the Hotchkiss and the Kent schools, they were all far, far ahead of me.
Yeah, because they'd gone to better prep school.
Much better school, sure. By the sophomore year, I'd caught up to them. They'd stopped working, and I'd started. So that it balanced out. But I did, in fact, graduate, and I did, in fact, send the guy a cable. He's a personnel director of a hat factory in Danbury at the time, which pleased me anyway.
Yes, no, that's terrific. Well, now, so did you graduate just before World War II?
Was that, I graduated in 1941.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And what then transpired is I changed my view of what I wanted to do four or five times. And the last iteration was I was going to be a lawyer. So I applied to Yale Law School.
But your undergraduate was just arts?
History.
History?
Mm-hmm. History. And my distinction work was in history. So I was applied and was accepted at Yale Law School. And my father called me up and said, I just told the boys at Brown, he was then president of Brown, that we would be at war in 12 months and you guys are going to have to fight it. And you don't have a prayer of finishing law school. And he said, I owe it to tell you that, like I told the students. And I said, well, so what do you suggest? And he said, well, you could get a master's degree at the Fletcher School of International Law and Diplomacy in a year if you could get in, so forth. So I picked up the phone and I called the Fletcher School, and they accepted me, which is, you know, boggles the mind these days. But there are only 50 students there at the time. And they said, by the way, you have to be able to speak a language other than English. And I said, I can't do that. And so I checked around, and they told me to go to Middlebury for summer school, and you sign a pledge you won't speak anything but the language.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up there, and the dean interviewed me in French, and I finally said to him, I haven't got a clue to what you're talking about. And he said, well, aren't you coming to the school? And I said, I hope so. And he said, well, you got more guts than brains. And he said, I'll admit you. And so I went there all summer and nearly died. But I was able to feed myself. And I was even able to pass the exam at Fletcher. But it was another one of those accidents.
Exactly, how those things bounce around. Somewhere in here, you got interested in banking, but
no, I didn't actually.
Oh.
After I graduated from Fletcher, I never did see my diploma. I'd taken the exam and went directly to the Department of State, and I was an officer of the State Department, and that seemed to be a pretty good career. But then I started writing instructions as a kid to the ambassador of the Court of St. James. And of course it went through all the layers. Secretary of State signed it and all this stuff. And I said to myself, you know, if I work my tail off for 40 years, I might become an ambassador. At which point some kid fresh out of Fletcher who knows nothing about this will be writing me instructions. And that didn't seem too to such a good idea. So then the war intervened, and I wore a brown suit for a while. And when I came back, my wife was teaching school in New York here. Mm-hmm. And so...
Had you married before you before the war?
Yes. Yes, we got married in 1942. And she was, Bobby taught here. And so when I came back, it was the middle of the, my mother was dying. I came home on emergency leave. And there was, she obviously wasn't going to quit right in the middle of the season. So I went to the family doctor and said, what do you think I ought to do? Dad sent me to the guy, and he said, well, you ought to go in the banking business. I said, you got to be out of your mind. And he said, no, I think you'd be do all right there. So I went to see the chairman of the Rhode Island Hospital Trust Company, and he offered me $2,000 a year. And I explained that as an officer of the U.S. Army, I was doing better than that. And he said, but he said, it's an honor to work for the Rhode Island Hospital Trust Company. And I said, thank you very much. And I departed without having uttered swear words or anything of that nature. And he said to Dad, I said, well, I might take a temporary job. Is there a decent bank in New York? And he said, well, the best one there that I know is Citibank. So I went downtown and couldn't find it, and asked a cop. And he said, you're standing in front of it. I said, how do you tell? There's no sign. He said, everybody knows. And I said, I don't know. So I went in off the street, and they hired me for 1 year, and I got lazy, and I never left. Mm-hmm. So that is known as career planning.
Yes. Did they offered you more than the Army?
Oh, yeah. $2,800.
$2,800, yeah.
And I got $3,000 because I had a master's degree, and there are 50 of us. And it was a revolutionary time because no one had hired anybody in a bank from 1933 till 1945.
Oh, yeah, that's right, too.
Because of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. So there was nobody ahead of us. And these guys were not buying any of the old line stuff. You know, they'd get up and they'd say to us, you can never repay the Citibank for what the Citibank will do for us. And people in the back of the room might make some comments about that, that we're flying P-38s. And one of the guys was the first guy across the Remagen Bridge. And as they say, we were born in Brooklyn and grew up on Guadalcanal, and they weren't buying any of this stuff. And so the bank was fortunate that they had a guy called Buzz Kyler, and he was in the 10th Air Force, and he was the head of personnel. And he went to the chairman and said, I'm going to hire these kids, and I'm going to pay them like $2,800. And they said, well, you can't do that. I mean, that's too much money. And he said, well, you have your choice. I'm out of here or I do it. Ooh. And he started walking out the door. He was on crutches. He'd broken his leg on a parachute jump. I still remember that guy. He was wonderful. And the chairman, to his great credit, said, okay, it's a different world. And so all of us started there together, 50 of us. And I was the last man in the class that made officer. Then I just got lazy and I stayed there.
That's interesting. That's an interesting story because we're all familiar with the GI Bill and the fact and the impact that all those GIs going into college had. But it had never occurred to me that the same thing was happening in corporate America because of the Depression, as you said, and this break in time when there were not, when there was no new blood coming into these organizations. That's fascinating. And I wonder if anyone's ever done a study of whether or not that to what degree did that have a significant impact on...
Well, it had a tremendous impact on Citibank.
So it must have across the board. You would assume most every corporation.
Because all these fellows, you know, they've been there and they've done that. And there were a lot of guys missing around the mess hall at the end of the war. And they were in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
We went, later had a chairman, a wonderful man from Indiana called Shepherd. And his son was killed on the last day of the war by a Japanese sniper. And he was his only son. And he was an amazing guy. And he used to talk to us kids. And he said, you know, you guys want to buy a refrigerator and you should save the money and you get enough money and then you buy a refrigerator. And we'd say to Shep, yeah, but we just lost 5 years of our life. We want to borrow the money, have the refrigerator now. And he thought that was bad karma in some way. Mm-hmm. But it struck me at the time and since, you know, that's sort of a dividing line.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the original, consumer credit really started.
Started was because
a bunch
again,
of us guys who were had parked 4 or 5 years of our life somewhere else, and we weren't particularly anxious to wait mm-hmm. to get a refrigerator.
Mm-hmm. The situation today is a lot different. Okay. You have grandchildren, I assume.
Yes, I do.
And children.
Yes.
Yeah. And how do you see their opportunities in the world?
Well, they're unlimited, and they're greater probably than ours were, because the economy is bigger, different things going on, the revolution in information technology. These kids today, I was writing a piece about the dog that didn't bark the other day. I couldn't think of the name of the story. So what do? I call my 12-year-old granddaughter and say, hey, go find out for me what the name of the story is, you know? Well, in my time, maybe you'd go to the library and maybe you'd find it. She came back with the title of Blaze, you know, in 10 minutes. I said, where'd you get that, honey? Well, I went on the net, you dope. I mean, that was perfectly easy to find.
Of course.
So that the information available to these kids, just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have any problem with their opportunities. I think they're just unlimited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your attitude toward life impresses me, and it brings to mind an article written by Dan Boorstin. Did you know Dan Boorstin? Daniel Boorstin, the Library of Congress?
I read his books. I've never met him.
Yeah.
He's an extraordinary man.
He was. His books were, and still are, extremely valuable resource about development of America. But he wrote an article, it was either for Time or Newsweek, I can't remember which, their New Year's publication, and it was like a centerfold spread, and it was in praise of amateurs. And he wrote this whole article about how the root of amateur, meaning ammo, to love, to do things for love, etc. And that impressed me enormously. And it seems to me that that's a sense. My sense is that ventures that really succeed, ultimately, if you look at the core, seem to me to be driven by that. That People are doing things because they want to, because they have a love of it, not because they said, well, this is something I'm going to do because I can make a lot of money or make a living at.
Well, I think there are probably dual tracks on that. There are some people who equate money, you know, I must have a Lexus and do all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And there are other people that you view it only as a side effect.
And which class do you put yourself in?
Oh, I mean, to me, an automobile is transportation. I have no interest in that sort of stuff. Over the years, I've made, after I left the bank, I've made some money. But what you do with it is you either give it to the government or you give it away. And I believe that the fastest growing business in America in the next 10 years is the administration of private foundations.
Mm-hmm.
These people, during the nutty period where everybody got 20 million bucks a year or something, what the heck are they going to do with it? They're going to establish a foundation. There are people like Sandy Weill, who are sort of a role model, who give $200 million to Cornell Medical School, and Bill Gates, who's done a great deal for health in Africa. But there are going to be hundreds of these things, and nobody is being trained to run them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be a big field at some point.
A big challenge is to make wise use of those.
To do it right.
Yeah, to do it right.
My wife's the president of the Hartford Foundation, and they give money to medical stuff, training nurses, IT in hospitals, what have you. And I learned from her that a year after they give the grant, they send around people to find out where the money was spent properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to have audits of these things.
Yeah, that's key.
But it's going to be, unbelievably huge.
So you're very optimistic about the future.
Oh, yeah.
You share Julian Simon's view. That
share what?
The view that Julian Simon put forward, that we're going to become more prosperous, do you share his view about people? You know, that people are the source of all of this prosperity.
Of course. Well, the wellspring of this thing is freedom. And 20 years ago, every country in Latin America was run by some form of dictatorship. Today, every country in Latin America, except for Venezuela, which is a disaster, has some form of democracy. And once you establish some form of freedom, that becomes free markets, and that means that people have an opportunity to better themselves. And prior to that time, there was no expectation that they could better themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And today, that virus of freedom, for which there is no anecdote, is spreading. And it's not even, and it's denigrated by a lot of the elite who think they know more than everybody else. And the facts are that ordinary people with a pencil make fewer mistakes than the people who think they're so smart.
Yes, so they do.
I have great faith in the common sense of the American people.
Well, thank you. And I'm sure there are a lot of them out there that are taking the same attitude you did about college, and they can make it happen, and they will.
Sure.
Thank you, Walter. It's been a delight chatting with you.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.